Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
15,000 people lose their jobs and a company sells itself off. The nuts and bolts of Hostess going out of business on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 21st of November. Good to have you with us. A bankruptcy court in White Plains, New York, made the demise of the Twinkie official today. Hostess is no more. The company now has permission to shut down and sell off whatever assets it has. Wonder Bread, Ding Dongs, all the rest, after mediation with its bakers union went nowhere. The ruling will make tomorrow an especially grim Thanksgiving for about 15,000 employees. Hostess CEO Gregory Rayburn said this on CNBC this afternoon.
We will drop down today from about 18,500 employees to about 3,200 for the wind down, and then that will drastically drop about 2 months from now.
This, of course, isn't really the end for the parts of Hostess that consumers know best. Its brands will be sold to the highest bidders as the company takes itself apart. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff explains how that's going to work.
When it's really the end of the road for a company like Hostess, in come the liquidators.
We're 1 minute we're in the bakery business, the next minute we're in the retail business, the next minute we're in the construction business.
Mark Weitz is the president of the industrial group at Great American, which liquidated Borders bookstores, among others. Companies like his bid for the chance to sell off the bits and pieces of a bankrupt business. And he says Hostess has a lot to offer.
From the machinery and equipment to their real estate and of course, their brands and intellectual property.
Brands like Wonder Bread and Twinkies have a lot of value. That's different from defunct retailers, says Jim Shea of Eaton Hudson, another liquidator.
Someone who bought the Circuit City brand, they probably didn't pay very much for it.
Circuit City's name sold for just $6.5 million, far less than Hostess brands will likely fetch. But the process could take a while. It's more than just selling off Circuit City's TVs or Borders books and closing the doors within weeks. Industrial companies have factories full of expensive specialized equipment. Richard Kay is a vice president at Hilco, which also does liquidations.
It may take many months to find, you know, the prospective buyers.
Liquidators tend to get a bad rap, but they say they're not bottom feeders or vultures. They're just helping creditors and suppliers get some of their money back. Jim Shea says at first, his wife didn't want him to tell people what he does.
Yeah, well, she got over that pretty quickly.
Now, companies like his are waiting on the sidelines, hoping for the job of ensuring no Twinkie is left behind. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
One more thing from Gregory Rayburn's interview with Maria Bartiromo on CNBC earlier today. He said he figures the sale price for the company's assets all in is probably going to be somewhere north of about $1 billion. Moving on to the what else is new department, BlackBerry lost another big client today. The National Transportation Safety Board said it's going to dump its BlackBerries for iPhone 5s. Government clients had been strongholds for the company. So what can it mean when even the feds want to switch? Marketplace's Eve Troe has that story.
When President Obama began his first term, he famously clung to his BlackBerry. FBI agents and military higher-ups have been glued to theirs, too, says Eric Jackson at Iron Fire Capital.
The reason why they've done so well in the government agencies has been security.
BlackBerry phones are secure in part because they don't have tons of bells and whistles and apps. But you know that awful saying, good enough for government work? Well, now not even that.
Even in the government, people today want certain types of functionality that they haven't been able to get from the BlackBerry.
Government has stuck with BlackBerry this long mostly out of habit, says Roger Kay at Endpoint Technologies.
It tends to hang on to technologies for longer and to be slower to adopt new ones.
So if agencies like the National Transportation Safety Board don't want to wait for the new BlackBerry due out this January, that is a real bad sign. Plus, Kay says Apple and Google have stormed Capitol Hill without even really trying.
The employees bring in their own devices and say, I want to use this, the BYOD movement. Bring your own device.
Apple's iPad hurts, too. Government agencies already using the tablet may go with iPhones for compatibility. Ryan Kim at GigaOM says rumors about the BlackBerry manufacturer, RIM, don't help.
It's hard for a government agency to make a decision, say, we're going to definitely choose rim when some people are suggesting that it might not be around.
Around in the U.S. anyway. BlackBerry still has 80 million users worldwide. In some countries, like Nigeria and South Africa, it even remains a high-power status symbol. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
The major indices up across the board this day before Thanksgiving. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I suspect many of you aren't working today, and that if you are, you'll at least have tomorrow off. I, for one, will be working. Feel free to tune in, by the way. But you know who is going to be on the job? Your neighborhood plumber, because it turns out this is a very busy time of year for him, or her. Murray Korf is with Champion Plumbing out in Woodland Hills, California. Mr. Korf, how are you doing today?
Hey, very well, thank you.
So now, I am told, or have been told today, that Thanksgiving is the busiest day of the year for plumbers, and so we thought we'd go straight to the source. Is that true?
Yes, and you can blame the housewives for that one.
All right, well, we're going to get some letters on that one. But why? What makes it so busy?
Well, number one is that garbage disposal, which, of course, is a very useful thing, but they overuse it. They stuff too much stuff and the wrong stuff down that garbage disposal.
Like what?
Well, you don't want to, for instance, we had a lady once, she skinned two chickens, and two chicken skins were stuffed down the garbage disposal. Immediate problem. Have to call a plumber.
Now, I imagine busy as Thanksgiving is, you get, what do you get, time and a half, double time? You do pretty well for yourself, probably.
Well, yes. Being a holiday, you know, you want to obviously charge the right price, you know, for that. But at the same time, you don't want to gouge the customers either. You know, you want to make happy customers, repeat customers. So that's generally at Champion Plumbing, that's our policy.
What makes Thanksgiving, though, different from any other day of the year? Is it just that more people are cooking and doing special things, do you think?
Yeah, well, normally, you know, you have family over, so there's about three ladies in the kitchen sometimes, and everybody's going gung-ho, which is understandable. You want to get a great turkey dinner out for your family and your in-laws.
Yeah.
And if you have your sister-in-law, she might not know that you have bad lines, so she's going gung-ho, stuffing stuff down.
Or my brother-in-law, I mean, you know, just to be fair.
Or your brother-in-law. Brother-in-law's probably worse than the sister-in-law.
Probably,
Absolutely.
Yeah, and now,
absolutely.
So tomorrow, are you on call tomorrow and Friday, or are you in the office? What are you doing?
We will be on call. We will be on call to help our customers in the area, absolutely.
How much might it cost me to get a plumber out to my house tomorrow if I needed one?
Now, if you need a plumber out there, how much?
Yeah.
About $155 on a holiday. Probably about $150, $155. It depends, you know.
Yeah, it always depends, of course. Now, is that per hour or is that a flat rate?
That's a flat rate.
All right. Well, then I won't feel so bad.
Yeah, and then also one thing to bear in mind, also if you have a lot of people in the house, it's not only your garbage disposal that can give you problems. If you have roots in your sewer line, a lot of people using the bathroom, flushing the toilet.
Yeah, we're not even going there. That's a whole different kind of show.
You're just sticking to the kitchen.
We're sticking to the kitchen. Murray Korf at Champion Plumbing out in Woodland Hills, California. Thanks very much to you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day, sir. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
This is going to sound obvious, but football is big down in Texas this fall. College Station, Texas, to be precise, home of Texas A&M University and one Johnny Manziel, the white-hot quarterback for the Aggies. The kid is really good, so good that they call him Johnny Football, a nickname so good that it's almost a brand name. From KUT in Austin, Ben Philpott has it.
It's a year of new beginnings on the Texas A&M campus. There's the new conference, leaving the Big 12 for the football powerhouse SEC, a new head coach, and a new kid leading the team at quarterback, 19-year-old Johnny Manziel.
Third and 23. Manziel trying to put it into it. Johnny Football with a night to remember. Touchdown, Texas A&M.
He brings that excitement back that we've been starved for in the last few years.
That's Texas A&M graduate Evan Otto.
Class 2004, a whoop.
He's just one example of the new cult of Johnny Football.
We love our stories, we love our traditions, and we love our legends. And Johnny Football, you have a legend in the making right there.
And at least one company is trying to capitalize on that. A few weeks ago, a Texas-based investment group filed for the Johnny Football trademark. The Manziel family then began drawing up their own petition for the trademark and were quickly joined by Texas A&M. Joshua Jones is a trademark and intellectual property lawyer in Austin.
You know, it gains a lot of attention now, but it's something that, you know, I think savvy entertainers have been doing for a long time.
Just this year, Anthony Davis of the NBA's Charlotte Hornets trademarked the phrase, "fear the brow," a reference to his athletic prowess and his unibrow. And Washington Redskins quarterback Robert Griffin III snatched up RG3. But those guys are professional athletes. Johnny Manziel is still in college and can't make any money based on his college football career. Shane Hinckley is an assistant vice president in Texas A&M's business development office.
The NCAA is very clear, and a player's name, image, likeness, or nickname cannot be used by the institution or by a private individual to sell merchandise.
If that Texas investment group actually started selling Johnny Football shirts at $20 a pop, quarterback Johnny Manziel, even if he doesn't collect a dime, could lose his collegiate eligibility and have to quit the team. So the school's involvement is as much about self-preservation as it is anything else. Again, Shane Hinckley.
Well, I think first and foremost, protecting his eligibility was the focus. But as this continued, you know, the thought process was, hey, if somebody's doing this and they're not associated with the university or the family, making money off of his likeness, that's not right.
But if the family gets the trademark, nobody will make money on Johnny Football until he finishes his college career. That means no Johnny Football t-shirts, no bobbleheads, no Manziel meatball subs at a local restaurant. Nothing until he's out of college. Which Texas A&M fans hope won't be for a couple more years. In Austin, I'm Ben Philpott for Marketplace.
Coming up, an heir to the great tradition of Levi Strauss.
Travel around and sell knives. I love knives, and so I'm semi-retired, and I'm pretty much disabled, so this is what I do.
Making money in the North Dakota oil boom, but first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street rose today before taking a day off. The Dow Industrials added 48 points, about a 3%, finished at 12,836. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ gained 9 points, a 1%, 2926 at the bell. The S&P 500 closed up 3 points, 0.2%, 1391, the number there. Investors punish stocks, as you know, for falling short of profit expectations. Zale, you know, those ads for Zale's jewelry stores, it gets beat up for not meeting loss expectations. Shares fell 30% today, 30%, when Zale reported a smaller loss than a year ago, but larger than expected. This after 5 straight years of losses. No, capitalism is not fair. Deere, the tractor maker, predicted a slowdown in farm spending, citing both budget and weather uncertainty. Deere lost 3.2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. We'll start with the obvious. It's Thanksgiving. The New York Stock Exchange will be closed. Instead of watching the Dow Jones rise and fall, Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade balloons will bob up and down. And across the pond, back in 1968, the Beatles released the White Album. That's one soundtrack option for your holiday meal. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is going to be a different kind of Thanksgiving for a lot of people in the Northeast. People who are thankful they survived Sandy, who are thankful for what they have, and who are perhaps thankful for the government help they're getting to rebuild. It can and will probably, with Sandy, come to billions of dollars. And that cost is raising new questions about whether it makes sense to keep on building in places where Mother Nature just knocks you down. Robert Young directs the Center for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
This is, it seems to me, the textbook definition of moral hazard, right? There is almost no risk to these people other than the dislocation of having homes wiped out, but they will be made almost whole by the federal and state government.
You know, this is a perfect example of where we should be allowing market forces to play a larger role in the decision-making process. You're absolutely right. The federal and state taxpayers, through a wide variety of subsidies, assume a lot of the risk of both building and rebuilding in some of these hazardous areas. And I really think we need to change that calculus.
Okay, but that's a tough sell, right? Who's the first politician going to be who's going to say, yeah, no, you're on your own, man?
Well, maybe someone from Kansas or the...
But then the Kansas guy is going to worry about tornadoes.
Ah, yes. But, you know, tornadoes don't destroy the same town 8 or 9 times in 25 or 30 years. But we do have coastal communities that have received federal disaster declarations 7, 8, 9 times in the last 3 decades. So, you know, there's a big difference what's going on here on the coast. We know where these vulnerable and risky areas are, and we have many places where there is repeat damage.
All right, this is going to sound completely superficial, but here goes. Yeah, but it's so pretty down there. You got the waves and the ocean and the beach. I mean, it's nice.
Absolutely. And the coastal economy is a very important part of many of the sort of grand scheme economies of these coastal states. But if the coastal economy is so vibrant, then they ought to be able to pay their own way.
Should we, do you think, move people out of known danger areas? Not necessarily, investment homes on the coast, but should we take communities that are on the Jersey Shore, right, which got clobbered in Sandy, and say, you know what, it doesn't make market-based sense for us to let you live here. You got to go.
You know, I think every chance we have an opportunity to do something like that, that's a long-term solution to the vulnerability problem. And trying to put the houses back on the beachfront and then pump a beach back in front of them to somehow temporarily guarantee their safety, well, we're going to be dealing with that issue again. Whenever we have an opportunity to take a community or an area out of harm's way and relocate those structures or do a buyout, then, you know, that's a long-term solution.
Yeah, but these are people's homes, right? I mean, grandma and grandpa and great-grandma and great-grandpa lived there?
Well, largely no. That's not true. I mean, if we're talking about the oceanfront, let's take North Carolina, for example. 95 to 97% of that oceanfront property is investment property. It's not primary residences.
It almost sounds like we ought to move to a cornfield in Ottumwa, Iowa, and be safe right there and just kind of hunker down.
Well, I mean, you know, we developed some of these programs like the Federal Flood Insurance Program because we understood that there are some places where we might want people to live in risky areas like farming in the Mississippi floodplain or something like that. Or, you know, we may want people to be in southern Louisiana fishing and servicing the oil industry. I also think we need to have a national conversation about, you know, where we want to pour federal funds and where we don't. Right now, it's just a knee-jerk response after every storm.
Rob Young is a professor at Western Carolina University, where he directs the Center for the Study of Developed Shorelines. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you've got a project or an idea for a project that just needs a little bit of cash so you can turn it into reality, Kickstarter, the crowdfunding website, might be the place for you. Most projects bring in around $5,000. Investors, for lack of a better word, usually get a little something for their contribution, a tchotchke or something. Now, though, some video game companies are using Kickstarter to raise not thousands of dollars, but millions. From KPCC, Ben Bergman reports.
In the 1980s, Brian Fargo created a post-apocalyptic role-playing game called Wasteland that was a critical darling and a cult hit.
What about Wasteland? I mean, they're always asking about it. But I would tell publishers that, and they just didn't want to hear it. So I tried to get a sequel done. I mean, for 20 years, I'd pretty much darn near given up. And then heard about Kickstarter, and I thought, this could be the way to do it.
Fargo says publishers weren't interested in role-playing games. They were looking for the next billion-dollar franchise. The video game he wanted to make was more like an indie movie.
We were a bit of an endangered species. Oftentimes there would be people that wanted to make the games, and there were people that wanted to buy the games, yet there was a retailer or a money issue between you and them. And so with Kickstarter, which is money, and with digital, which replaces retail, we can now open up that direct relationship.
The vast majority of funders pledged the minimum, $15. That lets them download the game when it's scheduled to come out in a year. If you wait until then, Fargo says you'll be paying at least $30. He initially set out to raise $1 million. That's how much he said it would cost to produce the game he wanted.
And we blew way past that. We blew through that in 48 hours.
Nearly $3 million poured in, and he's not the only designer who's seen Kickstarter gold. A few weeks ago, a game called Project Eternity raised almost $4 million, according to executive producer Adam Brennecke.
We were very surprised. We did not expect that at all.
Though most backers give the minimum, there are plenty more pledging $500, $1,000, even $10,000. They're enticed by premiums. Project director Josh Sawyer says the more you give, the better your gift. Sound familiar?
The whole Kickstarter process can be thought of in some ways similar to public radio pledge drive or funding drive. We really want to keep people enthusiastic and keep them feeling like we're not done. We did hit this goal, but you know, we still have another pledge to meet. We have another goal to attain.
No tote bags here, though. And those donors who give $10,000, they get their own portrait within the game and the chance to meet game designers in person. What no one gets on Kickstarter is a guarantee projects will be completed as promised. There have been scams on the site where projects took people's money and disappeared. There's also the fact that these Kickstarter donations are going to for-profit companies. You take all the risk of an investor without any of the upside. Project Eternity's Adam Brennecke promises that all the money goes into the game.
We are an established company, and we've made these types of games before in our history. So I think that's a level of trust that we have with our fans, that they trust that we will follow through with our pitch and deliver a good game at the end of the day.
To keep funders in the loop, companies post frequent updates about their progress. When we visited Brian Fargo, he was seeing what his backers thought of some of the video game's new theme music.
So far, we've had 86 comments on here already, and all of it's been just incredibly positive. With Kickstarter, a lot of the top talent is going, hey, I could do this myself, because this is a fun existence. I can tell you, we're having a blast here. There's no politics, no BS. It's fantastic.
The tens of thousands who funded Wasteland 2 trust he's onto something. Fargo says with Kickstarter, it almost feels like 1983 again, when he first entered the video game industry, before big money and big publishers came along. Video games are about the gamers again. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
In any mining rush, gold, oil, you name it, there are those who show up to work the mines or the rigs, and there are those who show up to sell. Sometimes the suppliers make the fortune, think Levi Strauss and the California Gold Rush. Sometimes, though, they just get by. Independent radio producer Todd Melby is in North Dakota working on a year-long project about the oil rush out there. It's called Black Gold Boom. And we're airing a series of his portraits this week of the people and the scenes that he's finding. Today, one of those suppliers, a guy named Bobcat John.
They call me Bobcat John because I had a bobcat for 20 years for a pet. And now I got a Canadian lynx, so I don't know what they're going to call me, but travel around and sell knives. I love knives, and so I'm semi-retired, and I'm pretty much disabled, so this is what I do. What kind of knives do you like?
Automatic knives.
Automatic? These are spring-assisted here.
Yeah.
Literally thousands of knives, anywhere from just your standard pocket knives to mother-of-pearl and abalone and turquoise and red coral and deer stag and elk horn. And then I have everything from fairly inexpensive basic skin and knives to very expensive Damascus steel.
Why did you decide to come to Newtown, North Dakota?
Because of the oil boom. I had tried selling knives around Idaho, and nobody's got any money over there. Here, it works a little better because there's more money flowing around. The economic conditions in Idaho are horrible. I live in Orofino, and it's the most depressed town in the state of Idaho. People are losing their homes and getting their cars repossessed, and it's terrible.
So what do you think of all the trucks in oil country here?
It's the craziest thing I've ever seen, by far. I can't believe it. You know, it's insane. I've never seen so many trucks in one spot in my entire life. It gets so dusty you can't even see the knives in the cases. Well, people always have to eat. They don't always have to stop and buy a knife. So those taco stands are doing a pretty good business right now. In the summer, I'll probably do a little better. But you can't expect to make the kind of money doing this as you can selling food. Food's a big deal because everybody's got to eat. Believe it or not, that little razor is more money than the big ones.
I believe it.
Yeah.
What are you asking for that one?
It's $50.
Todd Melby's project, Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Local Lore and the Association of Independents in Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, just when you thought it couldn't get any worse for the Greeks, word out of Athens this morning that police there have arrested a guy on suspicion of stealing the personal data of two-thirds of the entire country's population and trying to sell it to boot. Addresses, tax ID numbers, the whole smash, 9 million files in all. So be thankful, I guess, right? Okay, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 48 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ added 9 points, also a third percent. The S&P 500 up 3 points, 0.2%. Wall Street's closed tomorrow, don't forget. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will all be here tomorrow. So, you know, tune in. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.